WGN. It's After Hours with Rick Kogan and filling in for the one, the only Rick Kogan. Chris Jones here and my good pal Mark Caro.
Hello.
We're back, Mark.
That was the Feelies. They're doing it again, and we're doing it again. We're back again. On WGN. Thank you very much,
it's
people.
It's a great pleasure.
What a prestigious show,
Rick Kogan's After Hours, with its own dedicated, discriminating listenership.
You know, Chris, you and I have both worked with Rick Kogan, and we loved him very much, and we hope you listeners will appreciate we're trying to respect the Rick Kogan vibe, which we very much dig, and
we'll try and get
speak a little lower than I usually do.
A little more gravelly. And, Rick Kogan, After Hours.
And, it's an honor to be here. And we got some stuff to talk to.
Yeah, we got a great show.
Chris and I are not only co-hosts, but we're friends and movie-going companions. We went and saw Dunkirk this afternoon at the Music Box in 70mm, and we're going to talk about that, aren't we?
We're going to talk about that. We've got a whole bunch of things to talk about. We're both interested in criticism, so we're going to talk about rock criticism specifically, and the great Lester Bangs, who is the subject of an interesting little show at the Steppenwolf Theatre Company. We're going to have Eric Jensen on, coming on at 9:30. He's going to talk about, you know, kind of pay a little tribute to Lester Bangs, who some people argue is kind of one of the, you know, the great writers of all time, even though he wrote reviews. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Great writers can write reviews.
I know. You know, we'll have to discuss this. Yeah. But because I don't see that. Who are like the rock critics? We'll get to it later. But the rock critics now who sort of loom large, who Cameron Crowe is going to make movies about in 10 years, who are they?
Who might they be?
Who is the Lester Bangs? Who do we look up to in that same story? Does rock criticism... Well, we'll get to that, won't we?
Well, if you have an opinion...
That's in the 9:30 segment.
Get ready to call us, 312-981-7200. And we're going to talk about Trevor, which is this fascinating little pre-Broadway musical that they're doing up in Glencoe at Writers Theatre, all about the Trevor Project. It's a fascinating idea. We're going to have the composer of that show, Julianne Will Davis. She's going to be talking to us a little bit later
on. Does the Writers Theatre generally do pre-Broadway shows?
It would be a first, Mark Caro. It would be a first.
It's a big deal, isn't it?
It's a big deal. The people of Glencoe are excited.
And again, back to Dunkirk, we actually have some guests on that too. We've got Rebecca Lyon and Julian Anton. I think I just read that wrong, but they are from the Music
Antos,
Box.
Antos, I think, right?
Yeah, Antos. Yeah. I typed an N. I'm like, that's not right. That should be S.
Julian Antos.
Yeah, there you go, Julian. Sorry about that, Julian. If you're on your way here, they're going to be on as well and talking about the presentation, because it's kind of confusing. You sort of have the sense of, should I see it in 70mm? Should I see it in IMAX? What's going on?
I know, we're going to sort out the snob value, because you're into this snob value of these. I don't want to see the digital aspect ratio, how many millimeters.
But you don't want to see the digital in this. That's the whole, we'll get to it. We'll talk about the movie itself, too. Chris Jones, this is your country's history, because you main listeners, Chris Jones is British. So this is like big history for you, right? You found this kind of a moving experience.
There was a tear in my eye. So, you know, I'm sure, and it's, as you know, this movie has done huge business.
Oh, yeah, it's number one this weekend.
Huge business.
And it beat projections, which is what's important.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not getting any of it, but people are people are so into the box office, and I was like, hey, it won $50 million over the weekend. But for a movie like this, I mean, there are no stars in it. The star in it is Chris Nolan, who's the filmmaker, who, by the way, went to elementary school in Evanston. I don't think a lot of people know that because he's a British guy. So I think it's great when there's a filmmaker who puts his prestige on the line for, I mean, this is a war movie coming out in the middle of summer. There are no stars in it. And he filmed it on a high quality version of celluloid. There's no digital stuff going on here. It's a real statement for cinema. And boom, it's doing great. I shouldn't say boom with Dunkirk, but you get my point.
Well, you know, it's if you've seen the movie and you want to call us a little bit later when we get to the movie, 312-981-7200. You can also text us and tell you what you think. You know, what you think of the movie. Same number.
312-981-7200.
You know, I was, and I don't know. It's interesting to me as somebody who heard that story for so many years. The differences in the film. This is another thing you might want to call us about. The differences in the film and what I always thought Dunkirk was. There's a lot I didn't know. At least if you take the movie, what the movie says. Is sort of the truth, which is obviously it's a movie, but nonetheless, there's a lot I didn't know. For example, the role of the air, the size of the air battle that was going on, right. And the story that we think of as a straight sort of you know, nautical rescue, in fact, was really much of
a there was all this bombardment. They're sitting there, sitting ducks at the time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and then, of course, you know, for we Americans, a lot of us don't know what Dunkirk is. So for you, that's part of your sort of central history.
That's
and for a lot of people here who are going to see that movie, they're going, oh, Dunkirk, where's that again? What's that about?
It's sort of cool that it's happening while there are still people around who were knocking around then. There are still people alive. And, you know, if you think about it, those folks obviously are getting up there, and that won't always be the case. And so it's a kind of a, I don't know, I thought the timing of it was kind of cool. So we're going to talk a lot more about Dunkirk and where you should see it.
We're not talking about that now.
Just where you should see it. Should you see it in, you know, like we did at the Music Box in the 70mm film? Should you see the 35, should you see it digitally, whatever. Does it really make any difference? Is this just a sort of a snob thing or not? So we'll talk about that.
To be a snob.
We'll talk about that. But first, we're going to talk a little bit, we're going to talk a little bit about what we've done with our summer. It's been kind of the summer of music. Like, I went to see Jimmy Buffett last weekend.
Well, you interviewed Jimmy Buffett,
too. I did.
You've been named a permanent resident of Margaritaville, I heard.
I got to ask him about the Margaritaville. Did you know this? There are going to be Margaritaville retirement homes. So when you can go with a margarita in your hand, you know, getting drunk all the way to the grave. And I said, are you serious? He's like, why not? Why not? So it was kind of fascinating. And he packed out the Wrigley Field.
Of course he did.
41,000 people.
I think that was the first Wrigley concert was Jimmy Buffett.
2005. And he promised he would come back when the Cubs won the World Series. And the Cubs, in fact, did win the World Series. So he came back.
He was like,
So, and I want to talk about his encore. Let's talk about you at Pitchfork. All of those good things. We're going to take a break. Mark Caro, Chris Jones, in for Rick Hogan. We'll be right back.
He gets up real early on his morning drive, down to the office for his 9 to 5. He drives a 94 two-tone economy car, loves to tell the local bands down at the bar that he's the critic.
Oh, yes.
Hey, Tony Keith's singing about you, Chris.
We got two critics in the room, actually. We're going to talk about Lester Bangs, the great rock critic, Eric Jensen, stopping by in just a few minutes. You don't want to miss that. Here's this great tribute to Lester Bangs, one of the great rock writers of all time. So that's coming up. But before that, while we're on rock music, you were at Pitchfork. How was that experience?
Oh, Pitchfork. You know, Pitchfork was pretty good. I enjoyed it. You know, it's all about... Here's the thing. It's like I saw this LCD sound system on Friday night, and I was with some people who were kind of obnoxious, and so that gives you kind of that obnoxious feel, even though I enjoyed the show.
You mean the people you went with, Ron?
No, not the people I went with. The people who, like,
around
the really, really big guy with a really large head who was very tall, who was just shoving his way through with his girlfriend, who looked like she was so embarrassed to be there with him. And he's just shoving his way sideways through, because we're in a pretty decent spot, and he's just going to stand in front of someone. And this guy's, like, 6'4", and there's just, like, no call, and his head's really thick. Did I mention that? And then some young woman, like, passed out, and where she's falling down, he, like, pulls his girlfriend over so they can stand in that spot when they carry her out. And we're all looking at this woman like, you know, we're sorry, you have to go back to this guy. But then on Saturday, it was George Clinton and P-Funk and one of my favorite bands in the world, the Feelies, who we heard as their bumper music. And we had a really great spot by the red stage and watched them. And then there was Angel Olsen over on the green stage, and then back to PJ Harvey close up. And nobody was shoving, and the sound was really terrific. And it was pretty great.
So it's a big...
And then Tribe Called Quest was after that, too.
Was it packed? I mean, you could get tickets on StubHub pretty cheap.
You know, Pitchfork is... Actually, in any of these, even Lollapalooza, there's enough space where if you want to stand to the side and dance around and not be in a scrum, you can do it. But, yeah, we're sort of in that festival season because, obviously, Lolla's coming up, and Lolla's just longer than ever. But I don't know. Lolla seems a little overwhelming to me. There's just a little bit too much of that high school kids gone crazy.
Well, you know, there was a
Pitchfork where more the middle-aged guys like me are there. So.
There was a news story last night from Hartford, Connecticut, actually, and they had, you know, where Chance the Rapper was performing, and they transported – there was this kind of insane amount of drunkenness, I guess, and they transported, I think, like over 200 people to the hospital just for for, like, excessive drinking. So it's like, you know, sometimes people just get a little out of control on these hot summer nights at these festivals.
I mean, I have a very mixed feeling toward festivals, because on one hand, if you're out on a beautiful night in Chicago, I mean, if you're a Lala, you're looking at the skyline, it's fantastic. But if it's a band that you really love, I mean, the Feelies played 14 songs at Pitchfork, and they sounded great. They had to cut short a little bit because George Clinton went over, and but they played in Detroit the next night at a club and played 37 songs. So I would have rather been at the 37-song yeah. thing. But, and so that's sort of what the festivals, I mean, this has been discussed before, but what the festivals do to Chicago's club scenes, because they all have these, you know, rules that you can't play these club shows unless they become the official after-hours shows for Lala. And so the bands don't play in Chicago over the summer a lot of the time right. because they're playing the festivals, and if you want to sample a lot of bands, like I wouldn't see PJ Harvey and the Feelies and Tribe Called Quest and George Clinton all together otherwise, so that's cool. But if you really want to dig deep into one of those bands, you got to wait till they come back and go indoors.
Well, there was nobody indoors at the Jimmy Buffett show, and I would say that my favorite moment of the summer was Jimmy Buffett's encore in the bleachers. So the very last song he does. So as you know, he was the first, you know, rock act to play Wrigley Field in 2005. Promised he would come back if the Cubs won the World Series. Well, he's back. And he did as his encore. He just sort of popped up alone in the empty bleachers because they're not using the bleachers because of
right.
that stages. And he did a tribute to his old friend, Steve Goodman. And he also told me something that I didn't know. This is interesting to me. You might not know this, dear listener. So he said he first heard Bob Marley and the Wailers at the Quiet Night on Belmont Avenue. So I said to him, I said, well, does that mean the Buffett sound was born on Belmont Avenue? And he goes, yeah, it was.
Well, if you think it grows out of Bob Marley.
Well, he did. That was where he got, that was where his first island, he thought he did.
So and, there's a line from Bob Marley to Margaritaville.
Basically. Oh, definitely. Absolutely, definitely. Because, yeah. I mean, he shifted, right, from Steve Goodman to a more sort of island,
right.
you know, but he's also, he became, you know, he's become, he's got, a, by the way, a new musical coming this fall, Margarita, you know, kind of Margaritaville, Escape to Margaritaville, as if the fact that Margaritaville does not itself convey escape, which I think it actually does. But he was talking
about...
You can waste away there.
And he has homes called Margaritaville?
He has retirement homes.
Where you're going to waste away?
You're going to waste away.
Is that the slogan? Is it wasting away in Margaritaville?
Well, there's another Jimmy Buffett song that's not... It's got a title you can't say on WGN Radio 720 that I think is the most perfect one for the retirement home. But we'll just let the Buffett
We'll just have
fan.
To tweet that one.
We'll just have to tweet
that
one.
Chris Jones Trib.
That's one of the deep dives for the Buffett
yeah,
fans.
Yeah,
but, you know,
Chris
he
Jones.
Turned it into a real Cubs fest. It was like,
of course, the
World Series came out. He came out Cubs Go. I got to say, you know, I had a moment as somebody who lives in Wrigleyville, not just a short walk from that park. It was a nice night. And I got to say the Ricketts, they've really got a nice concert set up there. I thought it was I thought the stage was great. The sound was great. It was very, very pleasant.
I went to Tom Petty there. We got soaked, but it was very nice. It was a good setup.
They really
too.
Got it together.
Oh, sure. And he came out in a Cubs uniform for an encore as well. It's much more. I saw you two at Soldier Field, and I've seen shows at Wrigley, and Wrigley's definitely more manageable, aside from the fact that just going to Soldier Field, for me at least, is just kind of a pain. But it's not, no one's really close to Soldier Field that much unless you live in the, you know, South Loop or something.
Well, you know, Buffett's this incredibly savvy business guy, and he was telling me, he's like, oh yeah, we're splitting the production costs with James Taylor. So he was on Saturday, then James Taylor, who I think did not sell out, I believe, I don't know if
he's been here a bunch of times.
I think they had a little difficulty. I looked into the park actually Monday night, and I could see empty seats in the side of the stands, which was not the case at Buffett.
Yeah, he was here last year, I think. Billy Joel's been here a bunch of years in a row.
Yeah, and James Taylor, is he really right for Wrigley Field?
First time, I guess, yeah. But I don't know, do you need to go again and again? I know it's gonna be a little quiet night at the ballpark.
Right.
So I like James Taylor.
Nothing against him.
You know, Green Day's coming a little later, so that'll be the end.
Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga's on the list, right, in August. So
they got a lot going on.
It's like every night's a party in Wrigleyville these days. It's really that
wasting away.
Wasting away. It's really kind of, you know, popped up. Are you going to Lollapalooza?
I don't think so. I don't know. We'll see. I want to see Spoon, so maybe I'll see them if I could see the after show. Instead. But I don't know. Maybe I'll go. I usually like going to Lala. It's all right. Are you?
I don't know. I've only been once ever. Only ever been once in all the years I've lived here. So that was one of the very first ones. So
I covered it the first few years, and then I've been back for other ones. But it's like I've seen Radiohead at Lala, and I've seen Radiohead not at Lala, and like him or not at Lala. I've seen McCartney at Lala and not, you know. McCartney's coming up too this week.
Yeah.
But anyway, but you just came back from Connecticut.
Yeah, I just did a, you know, this is leading us into kind of our next segment. We're going to talk a little bit about criticism.
We could talk about other stuff with Connecticut too. Like, I still want to talk about that line for the lobster rolls. That was crazy.
We had a big line for the lobster roll.
All right, say what you're doing in Connecticut.
So in Connecticut, there's a thing called the National Critics Institute, which I run, and which people, we work with young critics in all the disciplines, movies, restaurants, film. And, you know, all the dance, theater, all of those things. And we kind of try to train people how to be a critic. And you go, well, you know, do you really need to train to be a critic? You know, what you really need is a job. And if someone actually gives you a job, then you're kind of entitled to call yourself a critic. Dan Sullivan, a famous New York Times critic, said that you're a critic when somebody gives you a job as a critic, and that's about it. But there are some real things, as you well know.
Sure.
It kind of helps to be able to write, which, you know,
kind of
helps. And that's good. And you maybe want to know a little bit about what you're talking about. So there we are on the Connecticut seashore, and you came up and did some of your fabulous workshops, and we had lobster rolls, and we had in the long line, and you had whole belly clams on
the
half
shell. No, they're not on there. Well,
a different time.
You can get clams on the half shell too, right? We did that that night out in Mystic.
Yeah, with the great Sam Sifton, the great food writer from the New York Times, came up and joined us. He's a fabulous guy, and it was so funny. I'm in, you were with me. We're in this restaurant in Mystic, and I'm thinking they have no idea the New York Times food editor's in here. He'll never be back, and they don't know. I was dying to go in the kitchen, and go, you know who's out here, incognito, my friend. But I never did it.
So this is a newish restaurant in Mystic, Mystic Pizza, which actually is in Mystic, and actually is a restaurant with a lot of stuff.
Lovely town.
A lot of photos of Julia Roberts from that movie up around that place. But we were at this other restaurant, and they had some very sort of, they had a lot of ingredients on the menu. And there was this one pasta that had about 15 different things in it. And one of the things on there was lobster tamale butter, T-A-M-A-L-E, butter. And I'm like, what is it, lobster tamale butter? Like, I didn't understand what that was. And so, you know, the young server came by and I asked her, what is lobster tamale butter? And she gave the sort of long answer that really didn't make any sense. Like, they're taking the lobster and they're squeezing the butter, the tamale part. I don't know what it was. But, so she walks away, and then Sam Sifton's just kind of laughing because I just wanted to see what happened. He's like, it's like, tamale is the sort of green, you know, roe part inside of a lobster, but it's not spelled that way. It's a T-O-M-A-L-L-Y. You may text us at 312-981-7200 if I just spelled it wrong. At any rate, it is not spelled the same as tamale, the Mexican, you know, corn-based food. So lobster tamale butter has nothing to do with tamales. It does have to do with the tamale.
Well, then he got upset because there were clams that were on ice, right? Those clams on the half shell, and they put paprika on the ice, and it kind of bled into the clams. And it was just an aesthetic.
Right.
I think it was all this ice in this platter, and the chef must have been like, oh, it looks really boring. So he put all this red
paprika on the ice. Is a little weird.
It's kind of hilarious.
But, and then Chris and I, we had a thing at night, and we're like, oh, let's grab a quick bite. Let's go to this outdoor lobster roll place. And we stood in this line for like 35 minutes. Before we could even order, and it wasn't that long of a line. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is just taking forever. And then it took forever for us to get them too. And the lobster roll wasn't even that great. And someone said they don't even think the lobster's even from around there. They're just importing it anyway. So it was kind of like, it put me down on lobster rolls, but I'll have good lobster rolls elsewhere. I've had good lobster rolls at, you know, Shaw's and other places here as well. But, and then that guy got in my face, and it was kind of embarrassing because I finally, because we had to leave to go teach our class, and I said to the guy, I said, is there stuff coming up? And this guy comes up to me, just this older, he had a little alcohol on his breath, and he goes, you know, your timetable is not their problem. And I'm like,
you Chicago, you city slicker.
I know.
You
and I'm just like, well, we just need to get our fooks. We got to go. So I don't know. It made me think about being a more mellow person.
All right. Well, when we get back, we've got Eric Jensen, who's performing the show at Steppenwolf in tribute to Lester Bangs. It's called How to Be a Rock Critic. This is Chris Jones, Mark Caro, in for Rick Hogan. After ours, we'll be right back.
So my advice to you, and I know you think these guys are your friends, if you want to be a true friend to them, be honest and unmerciful.
All right, you're listening to Radio 720 WGN. This is Chris Jones and Mark Caro.
Hello.
We're in for Rick Hogan's After Hours show. We have a really cool guest now that we want to kind of introduce you to, Eric Jensen. How you doing, Eric?
It's a real pleasure to be here, and that was the amazing Philip Seymour Hoffman, the immortal Phil Hoffman.
Playing the same character that you're playing right now at the Steppenwolf Theater, the great rock critic Lester Bangs.
Some would say the greatest rock critic, but I think that there's a lot of argument out there about that.
Nobody's doing a show about Robert Christgau right now. No offense to Christgau or Dave Marsh or anyone, but, you know, Lester Bangs is the one you were on stage doing at Steppenwolf, so.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a dream come true.
Who would be the other rock critics you think are rivals to Lester?
I'm rereading Mystery Train by Grail Marcus. I think he's up there. I obviously think in terms of gonzo journalist, Hunter Thompson is up there. I think George Bernard Shaw is up there, actually. He was a music critic.
There you go. You would not have thought somebody would come on and talk about rock criticism and talk about George Bernard Shaw.
Well, I have an affinity for both, so I'm a very strange creature.
Well, set us up with this show. So it's basically you're kind of watching Lester Bangs go through kind of the dark night of the soul as he's talking to you about his favorite albums and the albums he... So just sort of set us up what's going on in this show.
Yeah, well, the sort of conceit of the show is that it's the last night of his life, and we've all, joined him in his apartment. He probably got too drunk last night and invited a bunch of people over and forgot about it. It's a walk through that evening looking for a record, his favorite record, Astral Weeks. But really, it's just a walk through his life, how he came to love rock and roll, how he came to believe that rock and roll could save people, how he believed that he could be the messenger for that.
It's that intense, like the prophetic qualities of rock and roll.
I think that they are, and Lester certainly thought that they could save people. He came from a Jehovah's Witness household. He was raised around that kind of messianic fervor. So that's something we try to bring back to life on stage.
And there's something about his life that works on the stage in a way that, you know, Grail Marcus is a great writer, but I can't imagine the Grail Marcus, story at Steppenwolf.
Well, Grail leans on a fence post and kind of watches from outside the fence. Lester got in there and was more like a boxer than he was a journalist. I don't think Grail inserts himself into his stories the way Lester does.
Well, Lester also was at a time where rock critics were defined at that point. You know, like someone who's reviewing stuff now, like, okay, we know what a rock critic is. Mm-hmm. But a rock critic, I mean, like what he was doing, people hadn't done. And even just the idea of taking rock seriously enough to write about it the way he did was new, right?
Right. Yeah, it was a totally new thing. I mean, it was an age of innovation, before he was a rock fan, he was a giant jazz fan, too. I mean, his interest expanded way beyond punk and the normal rock and roll that you normally hear people talk about when they talk about Lester Bangs.
So the idea that he's killing himself, essentially. So did he sort of take on the more destructive elements of the people he was writing about?
I think he did. I think that he felt a need to sort of level the playing fields, not only by breaking the fourth wall with them and speaking frankly with them the way that I think that we are right now, minus the swear words. but also, I don't think it was as much taking down as equalizing things. And I think he felt he needed to live that way in order to accomplish that, and he certainly lived up to his reputation.
So if you're just joining us, we're talking about how to be a rock critic with Eric Jensen, who's the co-writer of the show and playing Lester Bangs every night, all alone on the Steppenwolf stage.
And big news, my wife directed it, so I'm sleeping with the director.
There you go.
If you have an opinion on Lester Bangs, or if you've seen the show, if you've got a question, I'm guessing you took a pretty deep dive into the guy, right?
Yeah.
So if you've got any questions, it's 312-981-7200. You can call us or you can text us. What about the idea that a guy can be a great writer and just write reviews? Because, I write the odd review myself, so I'm interested in this. And it's like, can you really be call yourself a writer if you're not actually, like, you are writing a play?
Yeah, well, I mean, Oscar Wilde was a great writer, and he wrote great reviews. And again, Shaw was a great writer, and he wrote great reviews and great plays, too. I think Lester felt very limited by the form. I think that...
What do you mean, the form?
I think that he got very tired. He wrote about it. He got very tired at the end of his life about writing just about rock music. He really wanted to write about human beings. What he didn't realize about his own work, though, he wasn't being critical of himself enough, because really he was writing about just the human condition. It just happened to be that rock and roll was the channel through which he wrote about it.
Wow.
You know, so we started off, there was that clip of Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is from the Cameron Crowe movie Almost Famous. And and it's about a kid like Cameron Crowe on, you know, tour with a fictional band at the, you know, in the movie. But he meets the real Lester Bangs, who's given him, you know, advice, kind of taking him under his wing, saying, like, we're the uncool, we're not cool. I think that Cameron Crowe's website is actually called The Uncool, based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So two questions. One, do you think Lester Bangs ever said those things that we were listening to him saying, that Philip Seymour Hoffman saying about, you know, be merciless and all of that? And two, does the fact that so many people know Lester Bangs through Almost Famous, does that affect how you're presenting him or portraying him or just approaching it at all?
Only just the following in the footsteps of Phil. Of Phil is just impossible footprints to fill, as it were.
Did he really know Lester Bangs? Did he? Do you have any sense of that? Did he kind of?
Well, I mean, I know that he listened to Jim DeRogatis' tape of Jim's interview when Jim was 17, over and over and over again on set. Okay. I listened to a tape too, but. You know, I think that's one way to know Lester. The other way is to read Jim DeRogatis' book,
Let It Flirt,
which is a really good biography of him.
It is.
And the other way is to come see the play. The other way to get to know Lester is how we got to know Lester. We went for 2 years. All I did was read everything he wrote. The estate said there were somewhere between 5 and 7.5 million words left, and there's probably only 4 or 5 people in the word.
5 and 7.5 million words.
Yeah, left behind by him. It's kind of astonishing. He had logorrhea. He couldn't stop writing.
So he wrote every day for long periods of time?
Yeah, for sometimes 9-10 hours a day. My friend John Morthland, who's no longer with us now, said Lester would come over to his house, not say a word to him, write for 10 hours, and then leave.
Just like Mark Harrow's, what?
10 hours a day. I'm so much more prolific now.
Probably because his electricity got turned off. He didn't get paid very much per word.
Yeah, I remember reading, getting Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, which was sort of his Lester's greatest hits, right? And that was the way a lot of people sort of got into him. If you sort of came to rock criticism a little later, so you weren't reading him about the Stooges when the Stooges were actually around, you'd sort of catch up and read that stuff afterwards and read all of his Lou Reed stuff. And there's one hilarious thing. Was it Jay Giles' band where he gets on there with the typewriter and he's trying to type out the review while the show's actually going on?
Yeah, I do that on stage.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really trippy. I mean, it's fun. It's fun sort of. This isn't the Lester's greatest hits show by any stretch of the imagination. We go deep into his psyche. Awesome. He was more critical of himself than he was of anybody. And that's the sad thing about losing Lester so young, you know.
But was that the source of his? I mean, there's always this idea that can you be a great, you know, do you have to be this sort of dysfunctional, morose? I don't know. I nothing against Lester Bangs or anything, but what I'm trying to get at is that why it was so great, or is it like, look, you can write great and have a perfectly functional life? What do you think about that?
He didn't get far enough into AAA to actually arrive there. He was actually in AAA in the last month of his life,
really?
And just had a relapse one night, and some people think he killed himself. Some people think it was an accident.
Well, how did he die exactly?
Overdose of Darvon and some other pills,
like cough syrup or
it was a pretty lonely, sad death, ironically kind of the same way that Phil passed away.
Do you have an absolute favorite thing that he wrote?
Well, my favorite thing he wrote is his treatise on Astral Weeks, the Van Morrison album. It's up there with Twain, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Hold that thought. Well, when we get back, we'll hear a little bit more about that. We're with Eric Jensen talking about Lester Bangs. It's Chris Jones and Mark Caro in for Rick Kogan. You're listening to 720 WGN. We'll be right back. Do not adjust your dial, everybody.
Yeah, we took a little while to kick in there, but
listen up.
We had one moment of radio silence followed by Metal Machine Music, the classic Lou Reed album.
The two-album Lou Reed album.
Yeah,
I can't believe
album.
You guys are actually playing this. This is fantastic.
We're actually going to do this the rest of the show. It's going to be the bed under which we talk.
All right, this is Chris Jones and Mark Caro in for Rick Kogan's After Hours. We're talking with Eric Jensen about Lester Bangs, the great rock critic.
Wait, you have to explain to us why we just played Metal Machine Music. Then.
Well, the legend has it that Lou Reed had to finish out a record contract, and this record was his final expletive to the record company. But actually, he was playing with Industrial Noise, and it's actually, if you listen to all four sides of it, it's actually kind of an interesting album. I actually have it on vinyl. But Lester would Lester would listen to it for hours at a time. Then one of his friends said, "Lester, oh damn it, please, man, stop! You're playing too much of that Metal Machine music." So Lester would put on the Carpenters as a follow up.
Did he actually know did he know music? Like, would you say, having done this deep dive into Lester Bangs, did he know music?
Yeah, he did. I mean, he was a big Mingus fan. He was a big Ornette Coleman fan. He was a huge jazz nut. I mean, I think that's the one flaw in the play right now that I really want to get over, is there's not enough black music represented in the play. And Lester found his early heroes in a lot of jazz musicians, a lot of unknown jazz musicians.
Well, since you wrote the play, presumably you can tell yourself you've got to fix it up. Right?
Yeah. Otis Redding is in there, but he's a little middle of the road for the kind of stuff that Lester liked. I think Mingus is a little more challenging.
What does that say about where, you know, just how we view criticism, that someone like him could have become such a large and important figure for so many people? I mean, obviously Jim DeRogatis, a rock critic in Chicago, wrote the book about him, Let It Blurt, and I think was in contact with you, or you guys, you know, talked about this, and he just had a side note, this big story about R. Kelly that everyone's talking about
right
now. But like the place of the rock critic was like, it really meant something to hear someone weigh in on what they thought of this album or that album. And it's hard to, you know, think about, you know, the critic be having such an elevated position right now. Oh my goodness, we really have to hear what this person, I mean, you know, Greg Kot, wonderful critic for the Chicago Tribune, but it was just a different thing, right?
I think it is. I mean, we live in a world now where everybody's a critic on Twitter and other things, but I think, you know, the artist needs the critic as much as the critic needs the artist. We're here to push each other. We're here to push the bounds and evolve each other. And, I mean, I think Oscar Wilde said the critic has to educate the public. The artist has to educate the critic. And I firmly believe that. If the story's not getting through to the critic, then pretty good chance it's not going to get through to the public. The critic's crucial, especially an educated one.
What were his relationships like with the artists you covered?
Oh, God. They at first would initially love him, and then they hated him. He became friends with everybody at CBGB's, you know, Blondie, Talking Heads, all those guys. And then he wrote Patti Smith a bad review, and her response, of course, was, "How could you do this to me? We were friends."
Right.
He was a massive contradiction. Sometimes he would give an album a terrible review, just dump on it, and then turn around 2 years later and say that the MC5 were the greatest band ever.
Right. It wasn't his like initial Rolling Stone review a negative MC5 review.
It was worse than negative. It was like a brush fire. it in some ways made the band not be a band anymore.
And then he
came around 2 years later and said that the MC5's first album was one of the greatest rock albums ever made.
He also did these wild metaphors, like, right? So he wouldn't just sort of write about, well, out comes the musician onto the stage and plays this or does that. He would start out with these most bizarre sort of literary fugues and then maybe get to the actual artist by, like, graph six or something. Somehow, you know, as you know, Mark, it's really hard to pull that off because people go, why are you talking about that and not about the... But he somehow was able to do it.
He was somehow able to circumnavigate his own brain and start somewhere. And it's sort of a little bit like watching, if I can say her name, Rachel Maddow on television. She'll start with something, and you're like, where's she going?
Right.
Where's she
right.
going with this? She's kind of a cultural critic, you know?
Yes, definitely.
And then she ends up somewhere that you didn't expect, and you end up learning something, which is kind of a strange experience to have when you're talking about somebody who's a critic.
Chris, when you read Lester Bangs, do you think, you know, I could get more Bangsian myself? Or do you think, wow, this is just a different thing from what I do?
I think it's really hard to pull it off. You know, when we're talking about that worship I was just leading, I was talking about how, as a critic, you can, you know, I believe you should write about humanity, you should write about the meaning of life, you should write about life and death, and how we are all taken from this planet at a time and place not of our own choosing, which most great play, which most rock albums are about, right? They're about mortality, and they're about,
that's why they call it a record. It's a record of a life. It's a record of it's a record of a moment in a life. And the beautiful thing about being alive right now, which I think Lester would love, is that it's a level playing field now. All of it is available to us. You know, there's just as much access to Question Mark and the Mysterians and Captain Beefheart and Charles Mingus and Ornette Coleman as there is to the Lady Gaga and the Feelies and other things like that.
It can be, is it, you know, when you do a living, or not in this case, not living, excuse me, a late figure, but a recently, you know, a relatively recent figure, there's often an estate, or there are people who try to control what you say about them. Have you got a carte blanche here to do your own list? There's not people who are going, well, we control this, we control that.
No, they gave us carte blanche to do whatever we wanted.
Who's they when you say they?
The estate. A gentleman named John Morthland, who's no longer with us. He's a rock critic who died this year. He wrote for Rolling Stone and for Cream.
And he's the keeper of the flame?
He was. Now it's a gentleman named Billy Altman out there in New York City, also a great
people,
rock critic.
Yeah, how are they connected?
They were Lester's best friends.
His
nephew also helps run the estate, but he's out in California somewhere. So no, we have carte blanche to do whatever we want. And literally, I mean, it was 2 years of reading, 3 years of cataloging, you know, with categories like drugs, beer. There was a 60-page paper on beer that I wrote. There was a 75-page treatise on the Yardbirds that was unbelievable, that I stayed up all night and read three times. And then there was stuff that you wouldn't show to your high school teacher. You know, there was stuff that shouldn't have seen the light of day. So,
and I think one of the things that makes him work in this context too, and this is something that I think Chris, you and I would sort of say this to any of the critics who are coming through this program or anyone who's a writer in general, is that he had a voice that you could hear it and you're like, that's that guy. That's Lester Bangs. Just like Hunter S. Thompson. When you hear Hunter S. Thompson, you're like, that's Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah.
And when other people try to write like Hunter S. Thompson, they're not being authentic and it's horrible. But if you can be Lester Bangs and be authentically Lester Bangs and have that voice and write in a way that really sounds like you, whatever the you is, I think that's one of the keys to being a great writer in general.
Well, the amazing thing about the first play that we wrote, which was called The Exonerated, we traveled around the country and interviewed 40 exonerated death row inmates, six stories.
Yeah, that played in Chicago that day, right? Lots of celebrities in it.
Yeah, lots of celebrities in it. And
big night.
It changed the conversation in Illinois. Actually, we did a command performance for Governor Ryan.
I was there, yeah.
We realized by doing that play how much of our psychology and our physical psychology is in our words. And so, really, all I have to do is get up there every night and say Lester's words. It's not about me. It's not about my ego. The actor disappears. It's nothing but Lester. That happened with Exonerated, too. You know, these people who we met, people had never heard tapes of, had never seen video of, would suddenly start saying their words, and then they would make a little body motion that looked like theirs, and it absolutely freaked us out. And it works pretty much every time if you can shape it right, it works every time.
So what's the plan? So it's a new piece, right? Mm-hmm. So tell us are you taking it to New York or what's going on?
Yeah, that's the idea. There's a couple of theaters in New York that have a great deal of interest. And right now my wife and I just directed a movie based on her first novel called Almost Home. So I'll take a break from Lester. We'll wait to hear how the film festivals come back to us on that. And then I'll go back and do Lester hopefully sometime in January in New York.
I'm guessing he has some fans who really know, like, there's other people in touch with you going, what are you doing? And, you know, are you being true to the guy?
Well, that's the funny thing, is that everybody had a different view of Lester and saw a different side of him. But so far, all of his friends who have come have given the play their blessing, including Ronnie Hoffman, who was a great punk rock photographer, and another writer named Robert Duncan. So I've gotten their blessing. So as long as his friends are happy, I'm okay.
So is this a great American writer, just happened to be a critic?
Yep, great American writer, just like Twain, like Capote, just like Thompson.
I just feel you could be a great American writer.
Chris wants to know, if you do this well, will the next one be called How to Be a Theater Critic?
That's right, that's it.
And then you could put on, how's your British accent?
Give me access to everything.
Yeah, well, exactly right. Listen, we really appreciate you coming in. It's a great show, and it's so glad you're in town. And, you know, if you're a fan of Lester Bangs, this really is your thing. I mean, it's like more Lester Bangs in one place than you've ever had at any
point.
If
you're a fan of rock music, man, come on down and sing Wild Thing with us.
All right.
There you go.
Very good.
Right.
Thanks.
A little bit of Metal Machine music, too.
Thanks, Eric. We'll be right back.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Welcome back to After Hours. This is your guest host, Mark Carroll, along with guest host Chris Jones.
Howdy.
We're filling in for the great Rick Kogan. And as you can maybe tell or not tell from that rousing music, we are about to discuss the movie Dunkirk. And Chris and I just saw that at the Music Box Theater. But we're going to discuss that movie, the number one movie of the weekend, if you keep track of that sort of thing. It's also an excellent movie from Christopher Nolan about the Battle of Dunkirk and really the evacuation. If you want to call us, call 312-981-7200. If you want to text us, text 312-981-7200. We have with us two people from the Music Box where they are showing this movie in 70mm, and his projectionist Rebecca Lyon and technical director Julian Antos. Welcome.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for having
Welcome.
Us.
So you guys are showing this in 70mm right after you've done the 70mm Film Festival. You have a brand new, or not brand new, but large screen that you put up just especially for this. Is this the best way to see this movie in 70mm?
I think we get in trouble if we say it, isn't it?
Go ahead and say it. Come right out with it.
Why not? We're really proud of how it looks. And this has been a sort of a culmination of actually several years of improvements at the theater that have been made. And I think, you know, every time we do 70 there, it looks a little better. And I think this time is probably the best. And I think we're probably best in the Midwest.
Yeah. Yeah, so we were discussing this earlier, and Chris was talking about how this is sort of a film snob thing.
Yeah, geek thing.
So let's explain.
It doesn't have to be.
For those of you who are out there listening who are maybe like not clear why 70mm versus 35mm or digital projection or IMAX, why don't you guys give us a quick rundown on what the difference is and what's special about the fact of how this film was made and is being presented?
Well,
they're looking at each other. Who's going to go?
I'm
going to step
let
in, Rebecca.
Talk mostly about this, but one thing that's really important, which is pretty simple, is that the film was shot on film. So if you can see it on film,
so is that true of all films now, or is that just
a lot of films?
Films
are still shot on film these days, but
right.
a lot of them are shot
digitally. So if you see some, so that's one criteria. Is it? Are you watching it the way it was shot? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And that's a general rule of thumb. It's also nice to see things on film that were shot digitally, but we're getting a little bit, you know, esoteric.
And the 70mm print, I mean, I saw this. I went up to the projection booth before, and Rebecca was nice enough to show me this. I mean, it is a much thicker film. That's why it's 70mm. So there's that much more information on it, that much more detail. And so that's what you can see when you're doing that. If you were seeing this digitally, how would it look different?
I think the main thing, I mean, people talk about resolution almost obsessively. I think it's sort of detrimental. 70mm has a lot of resolution.
What does that mean, resolution?
Resolution, it's how sharp it is. How sharp can you get it? In terms of pixels, when you're talking about digital stuff, there's 4K is like what is considered the best now and is actually entering the consumer market, and that's becoming better than what you see digital in theaters. People talk about resolution, and that's great. Film has a lot of resolution. Film is made up of grain. That's the lowest element of film is grain, and the smallest element of digital is pixels.
Right.
And I always think about it in that grain is beautiful and pixels are kind of ugly. So even if you have, you know, you have Super 8 film, super grainy.
That's some Super 8 film.
It's still gorgeous. It still pops out and grabs you. So there's that. And then there's contrast. Digital projection in its current state does not have a whole lot of contrast. And where you can really see that on this title in particular are scenes where you're at night, and you know, because it's cutting around in a lot of interesting ways, you'll switch from a night scene directly into a daytime scene, and that difference is very, very apparent. If you're looking at that on a DCP, it's not gonna, you know, on film it'll actually, like, your eyes will sort of become a little worn out because it's such a dramatic difference.
Right. DCP being the digital format of how they present films.
Digital cinema package.
Right.
So you guys have this beautiful theater, right? The Music Box on Southport. We all think of it as this great, gorgeous place to see a movie, but let me just ask this bluntly. Can you really compete with, like, the mega mall light? Can you say, okay, yeah, you get the historic theater and you also get, you know, like a better sort of technical experience at your theater? But that's pretty incredible in a historic theater, isn't it?
I mean, part of it is that we're you know, a lot of these big multiplexes don't necessarily have, they're not putting the care or the money into the technical side of things necessarily, because they don't want to spend their money there. They want to put it in the concession stand where they're making it back, you know. They want to sell pretzels and expensive beer, and we're selling pretzels and beer also. But I think we know that in order to compete, we really have to look and sound as good as we possibly can. It's very hard to be a theater nowadays that's a small theater that is a dump, that doesn't look good. They really are struggling. So I think we've kind of upped our game.
Yeah, because like 10 years ago, you wouldn't have said, you're saying that it, I mean, it wasn't that good 10 years ago, right, as it is now? Would you admit that at the Music Box?
Yeah. I mean, I've been there about 10 years, and I can tell you that things have improved dramatically.
Well, you guys added that screen for Hateful Eight, I think it was, and you did a 70mm festival when that came out.
Yeah.
And you've upped the sound as well.
Yeah, we redid the whole sound system.
The sound was a big deal.
Yeah, I have to add a disclosure here, just because I've been doing a monthly film series at the Music Box called Is It Still Funny? So this isn't a cross-promotional thing. But but part of the reason I did it there was because it's, you know, it's just a great vintage place to see, you know, fill a room and with, you know, people in the dark to laugh at a movie and to get the presentation done and everything else. And so it's interesting seeing stuff there. I saw the 2001 there, and you guys actually invested in getting your own print struck, which is, that's really unusual for an independent theater, right? To get your own print of.
How do you even do that? You're like, hi, we'd like our own print struck.
You
said hi.
Nice phone calls.
And
Amazon, you got the free 2-day delivery.
I'd like my own print struck, right. Mark Carey. Pick that up
for
me.
House.
Get my own print struck.
But that was a big deal, right? That you got that done. I mean, when I saw that, I've seen 2001 so many times, but like the colors of that print, as opposed to, you know, previous prints I've seen in 70mm, it really made a difference.
Yeah, everyone did a nice job on that. There's only one lab doing 70mm prints in the U.S., Photochem. They'll also process your 16mm home movies. but yeah, we thought it was necessary. Everyone loves that movie, and you know, how could we?
And
how could we not?
You're packing the house too.
Yeah. We show it a lot, and we show it every year. And it's not. There's some precedent. A couple other theaters have done.
Yeah, American Cinematheque, and actually the iFilm Museum in the Netherlands made a print and showed it the same week we showed ours.
Nice. All right, we're going to have to go to a break. We're going to come right back to speak more about Dunkirk and presentation and 70mm.
We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds.
Yes, this is Winston.
We shall fight in the fields.
It's Winston Churchill.
And in the streets.
And this is Mark Caro, and that's Chris Jones over here with
Winston Churchill.
Very rousing, you know, like high stakes.
The most famous speech you ever gave.
And this was after the Battle of Dunkirk, which is the movie that we're discussing. So it's Mark Caro here with Chris Jones on After Hours. We're filling in for the great Rick Kogan, and we are here with Music Box projectionist Rebecca Lyon and his technical director Julian Antos. We're discussing 70mm and IMAX and the presentation of this film, and the film itself we're going to talk about. But I do want to ask you this one thing. So about the presentation. So you can go to another theater and see it in IMAX, like in some, you know, multiplex that has its own IMAX. But no one is showing it in 70mm IMAX. So
the nearest is Indianapolis.
Yeah, I looked that up. I know. Or Des Moines.
I've been there. It's a nice venue.
Yeah, okay.
So why is that? Like, no, what, Chicago can't get it together to do that? Or
Navy Pier has...
Oh, right, they're down.
They're putting in new seats.
I see. Right.
So they're down. Bad timing for them, because this probably would have been a good engagement for them.
But good for the Music Box.
But good for the Music Box.
Right.
But if you're going to go... I mean, I don't want you to diss other theaters, but the IMAX that's showing in multiplexes in the suburbs, I think there's at least one in the city, is that a special presentation?
There's a special button for that called LIMAX. what happened was they sort of put their name on a bunch of multiplex theaters and moved the seats back a bit and made the screens a bit bigger. Mm-hmm. But it's a dramatic departure from the 80-foot screen.
So it's like it's a crummy version of IMAX, basically.
Well, it's fine. It's fine.
Is it a digital print of the IMAX print? So you're getting those aspect ratios?
It's slightly different. It's 1.9 to 1 instead of 1.43 to 1. So
it's a big difference.
It's a fairly big difference. Roger Ebert compared it to New Coke. Or maybe that was something else.
I don't know. And then I saw there's also something called IMAX with laser. What is that?
That's a different type of getting light on screen. Theoretically, there's more contrast, but there's a design flaw, and you have to install screen shakers. Because otherwise you will see...
What's a screen shaker? Oh, like it actually shakes the screen?
It shakes the screen, because otherwise you will see a artifact of some sort. I haven't seen it, but I can't. It's there.
So someone out there, I don't think that's in Illinois either, but if you were listening, if you're streaming
you
WGN...
So you can see that. If you really want to spend some money and be a nerd, you can go to Showplace Icon, I believe, is showing...
With the screen shaker?
They don't have... It's not IMAX.
No, they have a... I don't think it's...
They're doing a laser projection of the DCP, which is not IMAX, so it'd be different aspects.
So I've always...
They also have it on film, so you can go into one venue and then walk over and look at the other one.
I've always wanted to ask a projectionist, like, so you see a movie like... What's it like to see a movie like Hundreds and... I mean, do you sit there and get deadly bored, or do you go, I find something new every time I see this?
I sort of like it. Working in the Music Box, we don't usually show movies that many times.
Right.
Like they might do at a multiplex.
Right.
We have a friend and a coworker who's working in Wisconsin at a venue that's running 70 millimeter, where they kind of brought him in to run the projectors, and he's doing like 5 shows a day for 4 weeks.
Oh my god!
He counted it's like 100 something.
Is he doing Dunkirk? Or
yeah.
Oh my
Dunkirk.
God! So he knows
and he
every.
He did Hateful Eight. I think he's gonna be insane.
But when you're sitting in the projection booth on something like this, is it a matter of just getting the reel, going from reel to reel, and then you can kind of relax again?
That is true for 35, usually, if it's a nice new print. 70 is a little bit more nerve-wracking.
Why? I mean, you're there going, oh my god, it's going to fall off the projector, or
it's a little easier to scratch. I don't know, Julian.
Scratch the film?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
It's more temperamental. most 70 millimeter projectors were not necessarily designed for 70 initially. When they were designed, they had a 35 as the baseline and then added all this stuff. So they can do 35 and 70. Mm. There's only a couple that were designed for 70 from the start. So most of these projectors out here, they're a little temperamental. If you do something not quite right, you can put a nice big scratch in your $15,000 print.
Then you have to give them $15,000 if they get upset.
We just bought another 70-millimeter print. Put this one next to 2001.
It's difficult stuff. It's heavy. It's a lot of wear and tear on the projector if things aren't aligned properly. There is only one type of sound on 70 right now, DTS sound. So it's a time code that syncs up to a digital file or a disk. And if that drops out for some reason, there's no backup. With 35, you have optical sound and DTS and other digital sound, and it's less.
So I don't know about you, Mark, but I think all of this that these great guys are talking about is in service here of a really great movie. It's a great movie, Dunkirk.
I think it's great. I agree with you, and I also just think in general, I think this is, you know, people are already started doing this headline. It's like Dunkirk is the perfect answer to Netflix, right? Because there's this whole sense that films are getting smaller. You know, it's like the Sunset Boulevard line. The pictures got smaller. And Dunkirk is like an investment in this is film. This is the way film is meant to be seen. We're even going to use some of this, you know, big format. IMAX, you know, 70 millimeter, but even regular 70 millimeter, there are not a lot of movies that are shot in that. What The Master was, right? You guys did The Master. It does Hateful Eight. But it's sort of a statement for cinema, and it's a very cinematic, unlike The Hateful Eight, the Quentin Tarantino movie, which had some beautiful compositions in it and beautiful shots outside too, but most of it was inside that cabin. This is really told mostly through pictures, and there's not that much dialogue. And so it really is this kind of purely cinematic experience that you don't get that much, and you're not going to get it in your, you know, downstairs, you know, man cave or, you know, whatever whatever you want to call it. But you're big, you know, even if you have like a really huge, you know, LCD, LED, plasma TV, it is not going to look like it's going to look at a theater.
Well, it's a film, too. It's about this. It's a sort of a stirring film, but it's not excessive on sentiment. I mean, it makes the point very clearly that war is hell and that if you're stuck there, and the fact that everybody was on a beach and people were in the water all the time and the water was cold and you thought you were off the beach and then the next thing you know, you were being bombed. I didn't.
You're so vulnerable because you can't do anything. They're like going over your head, dropping back. You just can't do anything.
And it's all bad news because you're being evacuated at the same time. So I was struck by how much I didn't know about Dunkirk and how, you know, what a the extent of the aerial battles that were going on, that it wasn't just a question of these boats showing up, which I think as a kid is what I thought, that and then everyone got on the boats and went back, that in fact they were being, you know, there were all of these Luftwaffe bombers coming down at you.
Right. Yeah, no, it's stunning. And what did you guys think of it?
Did you guys get to see it? Yeah, we saw it together the other day.
Yeah.
You like it?
Yeah. I thought it was beautiful.
You wept? Which bit did you weep at?
Well, once the boats start coming in, yes. the last two reels, it's all...
It's true.
Yeah. Well, it's
spoiler alert, but yes.
I know. I don't want to say at which moment I got very upset. But
yeah. You were going to say something
that struck me. I was going to say something that really struck me, that because there's sort of the sense that Saving Private Ryan changed the rules.
Right.
And all war films since then have this sort of Saving Private Ryan. And watching this movie is very intense. It's very immersive. And part of it is, you know, the visuals are there, but the way he sort of puts you in that, whether you're in the cockpit of the plane or you're just on the ground, you know, trying not to get, you know, shot or bombed or anything else. But there's one thing that this movie, that which sort of makes this sort of a throwback, because it doesn't have that Saving Private Ryan and most of these have. There's no blood in this movie. Mm. There's no gore. There are no shots of, like, limbs and things like that. It's actually, it was striking to me how, you know, for a violent movie, it is, and you don't feel like there's in any way that they're sort of cleaning it up for you.
No,
but the way that it's shot, there's actually no blood and gore. And if you sort of watch movies because you're scared that like someone's going to get their head blown off or something, like spoiler alert, no one's getting their head blown off in this, but you're still feeling the impact and you're still kind of ducking in your seat. But it's all there sort of cinematically. It's like, it's almost like, you know, Psycho. It's, you're not going to see the knife go into the flesh, you know?
And I think it makes this point really clear that here was the moment when the British public actually, you know, got their little boats and took them into a war zone and actually joined the war effort. An older guy, played by Mark Rylance, and two young kids. And it sort of reminds us that everybody sacrifices in war, not just the servicemen and women, but everybody in this case. And it kind of, it was that defining moment. And there's something sort of deeply moving about it. Great movie.
Yeah, so, all right, Rebecca.
But how did it look?
It looked fantastic. You guys did a great job. It looks great at the Music Box. You could see it 70 millimeter in other theaters as well. You could also see it digitally in some other places. But, you know, we are film snobs. And if you want to see great film, see it on film. It was shot on film. It was done just for you. It is Dunkirk at the Music Box. Thank you very much to Rebecca Lyon and Julian Antos. Thanks for coming by. We hope to have you again. I'll see you at the Music Box soon.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to WGN Radio. This is Mark Caro here with Chris Jones.
How you doing, everybody?
We are filling in for Rick Kogan and the show After Hours. And we're here in the home stretch. It is 10:34. And we have another special guest for us.
What a show, Mark Caro. What a big show tonight.
Oh, my goodness.
Big show.
This show is like 70-millimeter radio.
It's just wide format.
It's like IMAX 70-millimeter radio. You just can't get this, you know, on the other parts of the dial.
You cannot.
No, you
absolutely cannot.
And something else you can't get is often shows that are like being created for Broadway.
For the Broadway.
In Chicago and often in the north suburbs at, you know, the Writers Theater.
Yeah, in Glencoe. So, okay, so here's it. Just listen up. This is a fascinating little segment we've got for you. Joining us right now is Julianne Will Davis. How you doing?
Wick.
Nice to see you.
Yes, nice to see you guys. Thank
Sorry
you for
that.
Inviting me.
Yeah, and you're the composer of a new musical in Glencoe called
yes.
Trevor, right?
Yes.
That is, I think, aiming at the Broadway. It's got Mark Bruni, the director, who did Beautiful, the Carole King musical on Broadway. So it's a lot of Broadway peeps. A lot of Broadway peeps working on this. So what is this about? Like, it has its origins in, like, an Academy Award-winning short. There's a thing called the Trevor Project. So fill us in on what exactly this little thing going on in Glencoe might be.
Sure. Trevor, the musical, is based on the Academy Award-winning film short called Trevor, which... Peggy Reisky directed, James Lacine wrote.
What year? When did that come out?
You know, the film was in 1994,
oh, wow.
I believe.
Wow.
And in 1998, it was shown on HBO, and that's when, actually, that was the beginning of the Trevor Project, because they realized that there wasn't any kind of suicide prevention hotline.
So what's the film about? What happens in the film?
So the film is about a boy, 13-year-old boy, middle school, who has a love for music and life and a fascination with Diana Ross. And it's,
don't we all? Don't
yeah,
we all.
Exactly.
Mark Carroll was just saying how fascinated he was with
you know, she was, what, in Indiana recently?
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
a couple of, like, last week.
Yeah,
or
she was in Chicago,
yes,
I think,
yes,
too.
Well,
yeah.
So
she gets around.
She does. And so Trevor has this fascination with her, and it's just really about his journey in discovering himself. And, you know, he's different. He is special, and, you know, like all of us know who have gone through middle school,
yeah.
that's not the place to be special.
You could not pay me enough to go back to middle school. There
no,
would be no sum of
actually,
money, Julianne, that would get me back there.
The worst time, I think, of most people's
what
lives.
What was it like for you? Were you happy in middle school?
I think I was miserably quiet, you know, or quietly miserable.
Mark Carroll, you were just the most popular kid at ETHS.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
No,
cool.
No, this is not true. This is actually, this is not true. I was nerdily friendly.
Nerdily friendly.
I aimed for the cooler end of nerdishness, I guess. You know, I was not going to get out of the nerdishness part, but if I could sort of not be completely... You know, terrible. But, you know, but this is, you know, Trevor, which, and I've seen the film from 94. I mean, that's a movie about a junior high school kid who's learning to come out, basically.
Yes.
Learning to be in touch with his sexual identity. And now this is much more of an open, sort of people are more comfortable with that, yet it's also still obviously very difficult for a lot of people. How is the musical now being approached in a way that, you know, reflects the 23 years that have passed since
sure.
the short?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've thought about that a lot, but I think it's just evident in if you take a look at what's happening in the world right now, you know, there's been the surge of bullying and intolerance and
right.
the anti-LGBTQ laws that are coming up, that I think it's really kind of more important than ever that we really reflect on what the message is of the film and that it's okay to be yourself and your sexual identity is something that... should not necessarily define you, but also should not be the thing that shames you.
So you're a songwriter, right? So how did you approach the songs in this in a story like this?
Well, my collaborator Dan Collins and I, we kind of approach it from a place that, you know, we watch the film and, you know, we're writing a full length musical and the film's like 17 minutes
right.
long.
Right. So it's not a lot. You got to add some stuff.
We had to make up a lot of stuff. So, you know, and watching it several times and fortunately the producers were very much open to us creating material and backstories for a lot of the characters that may not be in the film short. So what Dan and I usually do when we start any project is we find a moment that really speaks to us, and then we just write a song.
Give us one of those moments. What was a moment that you really spoke to and you wanted to write a song about?
Well, one of the moments is actually the moment before Trevor attempts suicide. It's like, you know, when you're at that place where you find there's nowhere else to turn and that you are so alone. And so that was one moment that we wrote, and in the very beginning. And then also the relationship that he has, because he falls in love with a boy who is like the school jock, the most popular boy in school. He pals around with him for a while until the moment that it's, you know, he finds out that Trevor actually has this big crush on him. And then it's like so embarrassing to him that he really distances himself in a really tragic sort of way. And that's the thing that leads Trevor to feel like he has no other alternative. So one of the other moments that we wrote was, you know, meeting Pinky in this moment. Pinky is the name of the character that he
the jock.
The jock. Called Pinky.
Ironically named.
Yes. And so them having this moment of playing basketball together where Pinky's trying to teach him the game of horse. And so that was one of the
moments. So there are kids in the show, right? Are there actual kids?
Young, incredibly talented.
From Chicago?
Young. The majority of them are.
Is that right?
The majority of them are. We have two that are from New York, but the rest of them are these amazingly talented kids.
From beautiful Glencoe? Or where are they all from? They're from the suburbs?
All around the Chicago area, yeah. And it's a really joyful room to be in every day.
So when does this open?
We go into previews on August the 9th.
Okay.
And then, I'm sorry, I'm having to think about dates. It's late. And then also we open on the 16th of August.
So this is the first ever, like, pre-Broadway in Glencoe. This is a kind of a big thing for the village of Glencoe. Are you getting, like, the key to the city?
Listen, Glencoe is an awesome place. And, you know, the Writers Theater has been incredibly, you know, the resources they've provided to us and, you know, the support that they've provided to us has been.
And this is kind of a project that matters. This isn't just another show for you, right? I mean, this is kind of a special. This movie is special to a lot of people, probably some people listening right now.
It's a special story. It's something that we really believe in. Dan and I always seem to be attracted to the stories of, you know, the underdogs. And so this story is, really special to us.
Chris and I were talking earlier about, because Chris was teaching at the Eugene O'Neill Center.
Oh, yeah.
And was running the National, the Critics Institute, and I was teaching there, too. And we saw a musical in previews, and I saw that you've workshopped things there as well.
Yes.
And the thing that it reminded, just when we were there, just you're constantly reminded that these things take so much work and there's so much refinement. I mean,
oh my God.
Like, where, like what, if you just could predict it, like, what percentage of where the show is now will be where the show is by the time you're up and running on the 16th of August, or even at the end of the run?
Well, you know, we've done a lot of rewrites in the last couple of weeks.
In your hotel room, writing a new song.
Absolutely. And so we've done a lot of work. I think at this point, the show is going to be pretty similar. We'll probably do some tweaks in between now and then, but we feel like we've got a really strong show. We did a workshop at the Writers Theater back in March where they gave us the time, and some of the kids that were in that workshop in March are now on the show, and so that helped us get the show to a much better spot, too. So we feel pretty good about it right at the moment.
Well, we totally wish you luck, do we not, Mark Carroll?
We do.
Pre-Broadway in Glencoe.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. And you could find the Trevor Project online as well. And you can also find the Trevor short. I watched it on YouTube.
Yeah,
I think you could find
it. It was on HBO.
So, and you'll see what we're talking about. And, and you know, there are a lot of good support materials about, you know, suicide prevention and everything else. So thank you so much.
Thanks
for coming.
So much.
Thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Julianne Wick-Dave is composer of Trevor the Musical, coming soon to Writers Theater and then who knows where. Thank you very much. We're WGN Radio. We'll be back right after this. Yeah. Welcome back one last time to After Hours with guest hosts Mark Caro, that is I, and Chris Jones.
How you doing?
That is
Thank you for coming with us tonight.
We are filling in for the wonderful, fantastic colleague, friend, Rick Kogan, who I assume will be back next week. But you got us for another 15 minutes or 12 minutes, and we're doing it again, and we're looking forward to the... It's like that halfway point of the summer, Chris, where
it is.
It's sort of melancholy. On the other hand, it has, you got the best stuff at the farmers markets now, right? You got the peaches.
It's one way to look
at
it.
No, it is. You got maybe the melons are coming in. I've been waiting for the corn. The corn's getting better. It's a big deal. The water's getting warmer. Like Michigan, it was like the water was so cold the first half of the summer, right? So now it's getting a little, I haven't been in.
Well, it's been a longer, you know, there's been a longer spell. Somebody, I was talking to somebody about sort of noticing at some of the arts events around town that the audiences weren't as big. Even at Cirque du Soleil on Friday night, I was struck by there were a few empty seats. And somebody was telling me that they reckoned it was because we've had that extra 6 weeks of good weather this year. It's not been too hot. It's just been, it's been a really kind of beautiful summer so far. I'm kind of
started a little late, but
a little late, but it was nice in June. Exactly. I mean, we've had a, you know, the
so good weather's bad for the arts. Is that what we're
saying? I think it. I think weather. What? Yes, I do actually. In the summer, like weather that makes people want to be outside is not so good for the arts, but it's good for Chicago. You know, I was on Navy Pier this afternoon. It was crazy over there. I couldn't get near it. It was crazy. So, you know, it's, I think it's a great summer. I always get a little melancholic going into August when you start seeing, you know, you start seeing those back to school ads, which are always kind of a drag. But there's lots to go. There's lots to go.
There is. Yeah, you got full. You still have a lot of stuff. And you know, September is actually the nicest month in Chicago.
It is,
except for the fact that if you're going to school, you got to go back to school.
Right. Or back to work.
Back to unless you work all summer.
No, I just find in my job, I always find the summer is a much pleasanter. You know, it's an easier time, and September is kind of gets very crazy. And but I don't know. I just get sad when it gets to August. I've got to change my attitude.
Yeah. Don't get about sad.
No, because you're right, because September is the nicest month, isn't it?
I get sad like June 22nd when I realize the days are getting shorter already. And I'm like, wait a minute, we're just getting started here.
Yeah, exactly.
But so what are you still looking forward to? I mean, what do you what's on your plate?
Well, I'm looking, you know, hoping for a little vacation. That'll be good. I still don't know where I'm going. I've got my vacation, but I haven't actually figured out where I'm actually going. But I'm going to, you know, I'm looking forward to that. What am I thinking? In the arts world this week, we've got An American in Paris. Beautiful ballet based on the, you know, the well-known movie. That's opening on Wednesday. I'm kind of looking forward to seeing that. I'm looking forward to seeing Trevor that we talked about earlier that's coming to Ryder's Theatre in August. I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to getting out to some of the festivals. I'm looking forward to Gourmet Chicago. Looking forward to some of the nice stuff that's that little bit mellower in the summer as those, you know, days become more golden and, you know, I'm just sort of enjoying that.
Those golden, hazy, lazy golden days of summer.
Yeah, exactly.
You get out on the lake, that's always a good thing.
It's always, it's nice to be on the lake and enjoy that, you know, enjoy the warmer waters of Lake Michigan. Can't beat it.
I think the Cubs are tied for first again.
Yeah.
It was pretty quick.
So hopefully we'll be over there seeing a few good games at Wrigley Field. A few more concerts, Lady Gaga.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to go.
You're not up for that?
I'd be up for it, but I probably won't.
What are you looking forward to?
I was actually going to ask you something about, so you're planning a vacation.
Yeah.
So I need to do something about my status on airlines because I just feel like
I don't get treated with the respect you deserve.
I have like an airline credit card and I travel
a ton.
And I feel like I've never elevated above peasant. They actually say we're boarding the peasants now and that's when I have to get on the plane.
There was a great Second City sketch back in the day. Great sketch where it was like everybody's at a boarding gate and they go, now boarding the premier, executive premier, 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 special premier. And everyone, you know, it goes through like 400 different categories and it's like finally it gets to you and there's no seats.
No, it's like if I'm in group six now, that's considered pretty good.
Yeah, group six is all right. Group eight is when it really bites, when you get down to group eight.
But I know, and the tip I got was that if you check in online, you're automatically in group six, at least.
But you got to have status.
How do you get status, Chris? Because I know that you have more status.
You got to fly. You got to fly a lot. You know, that's the key. They look after their best customers. I mean, the reality of the airline industry is that most people fly very rarely. So if you fly fairly often, you know, you've also got to play the game a little bit. I think, frankly, you got to fly on one airline only.
I just tend to. I mean, I know you have the credit card and stuff, but it's just, I don't know. I just have peasant stamped on my forehead. You know, it's like the caste system. You just can't sort of move up in class for some reason.
Well, you heard the news. Like, you know, you heard Roger say that basically if you're flying to the East Coast tonight, forget it. So I
When I was flying back from Hartford, I had like my 12-hour day where my flight was canceled, and then I went to fly to D.C., and then that flight I missed, and oh, my goodness. And they just don't have anyone working customer service, so you just end up calling on – they're like, if you have a cell phone, just call them because this line isn't moving.
I had a thing. I was calling one day. I was calling American Airlines, and they have a little thing now where they say, if you would like not to – if you don't want to wait on hold, we'll call you back, and you will not lose your wait in line. And they go, we will call you back within – then there's a pause, and it goes, more than 2 hours. I'm like, more than? So we're at the end category. They must have like 10 to 15
right.
minutes.
Yeah.
And it was like more than, not 2 hours, but more than two
hours. So in other words, you could just stay on hold for that long.
For like 2 hours.
All right. So we could do a whole show on customer service. Because I get this whole thing where I call up places, I mean, and they're just like, your call is very important to us.
But it's
please
not.
Hold. And I'm like, that is so contradictory. It's like, if I'm important to you, then hire someone to pick up the phone, you know? But... So, I don't know. That was like a pediatrician's office. So, true. So, I don't know. But, you know, it's like, yeah, because everyone's going crazy. Because you have the United Airlines, you know, incident and all
right.
of that. But it's more like the little stuff that kind of brings
Ann Coulter, everybody got upset. She got upset because she didn't get a premium seat. So, she has status, Mark.
She has status. And she's, like, talking about how she's her $10,000 an hour. It's like, well, then it's five first class. You're making $10,000 an hour, and you're like talking about your $30 seat upgrade because you know you checked the little X. Like, fly first class, Ann Coulter. Give me a break. But anyway.
Well, I would say any listeners out there, if you were like right now waiting at O'Hare listening to us, or you're on the way to the airport on the Kennedy, we wish you luck tonight.
Wish you luck,
especially if you're flying to the East Coast.
If you're taking a cab back from O'Hare, give it a nice travel. If you're on Lakeshore Drive, look out for that water incident over by Chicago Avenue.
I decided yesterday afternoon, I had a free afternoon. I said, my family were all gone. I'm like, what do I want to do? You know what I chose to do, Mark Carrow?
Does it involve a train?
It does. I took, for the first time in my life, the South Shore Railroad, which I'd never been on. I have never ridden this.
I lived here 20
years.
Like Randolph?
I got it at Van Buren, in fact, and I rode all the way to Michigan City. Had a really good time. I talked to a few nice people. And then I made the mistake.
Talked to a few nice people?
I did, on the South Shore. They're very nice
people. I thought like you went to Michigan City and talked to a few
I did that too, but I also talked to some people on South Shore Railroad.
What were you doing in Michigan City?
I was just walking around. I might have played a hand of blackjack while I was there. Might have done that.
Okay.
Might have had a beer or two.
You can play blackjack. It's fine, Chris.
Might have done that. And then I was going to walk. I thought, and I'm going to take Amtrak back. So I go to Michigan City to the Amtrak station. It's supposed to be 9:30. But luckily, there's a bar at the Michigan City. There's a beautiful outdoor restaurant in Michigan City right at the Amtrak station. So the train is like 2 hours late. So I just wander into this bar, and I'm just sort of sat at the bar with these lovely people, did a couple of their special shots, and just sort of waited for the train. And I thought, life is good. And then the train, you know, 2 hours later, it chugs into the station. And that was my evening.
Why was the train so late?
I don't know. Well, those trains are terrible. Those Amtrak trains are always late from Michigan. Always late. They're the worst. I mean, you think planes are bad.
I mean, it's not like turbulence or anything.
No, no. It's freight train interference. That's what it is. That's the way That's the way trains operate in these United States. They're constantly dodging freight trains wherever they go. And so it's a couple of hours late. But I will say, if you were late for a train, the place to be late for a train or the train to be late for you is at the Michigan City Amtrak station.
Would you recommend as an adventure to just get on a train somewhere?
Yes,
and decide to get off. You could even just do Metro. You could just get on a train. So, you know what? I'm just going to get off in some town. I'm tired of walking around my little neighborhood, business district, or downtown, in my suburb, or wherever you are. Just get on a train and go somewhere else.
One time I was on a plane flying to New York, and in the next seat to me is a lovely woman who told me she was 95 years old, and she was a major, sort of one of the first women architects in New York. And I said, what do you do now? She said, every day I get up and I get in a taxi cab in New York and I say, take me to a completely different neighborhood. And the taxi thinks I'm crazy, and often they don't want to do it. But they eventually do it, and then she just walks around a different neighborhood. She said every day goes to a completely different neighborhood. I think it's a cool – I was like, good for you.
And a perfect summer thing to do.
Perfect summer thing.
When you're feeling that melancholy of, oh, it's almost August, the summer's winding down, get on a train.
Have you gotten on the 606 this summer? That's a nice summer thing.
I've gone on the 606.
Yeah,
it's very nice.
Why not do that tomorrow, folks? If you've got a day off, why don't you take a stroll on the 606?
It's Monday. People probably are working. Yeah. You could have done it today, but you could still do the 606.
It's better in the week. It's better in the week on that.
I mean,
the weekend it's kind of crazy on there, but it's in the week it's really great. What a beautiful way to
then get some gelato. kiosks there, though. Like they have, you know, the High Line.
Right, New York. They got all that stuff
so
going
I
on.
I know. Not to
museums and the whole
all right,
thing.
I think we got to run to a commercial.
Oh, what
right
a great
now.
Show, though. What
okay, we're
going
to go commercial, come back. We'll go to the news in just
you guys
a second.
To say goodbye? Okay.
No, we'll come back and say all goodbye. Right. But we're going to go to commercial right now. WGN Radio. Thank you. We'll be right back.